Beth Kodesh are those laws that apply for 12 months?
They would apply only for the parents, for the loss of parents, and they concern so far the Bet Simcha. You're not allowed to go into the Bet Simcha. Yes, ma'am.
Orthodox man I know had his wedding scheduled. His mother died. He went ahead with the wedding. I was not surprised. I'm not sure when it was.
Well, we're going to get to that when you have conflict between a wedding and a funeral, okay? But this is slightly different at this point. We're dealing with a normal case of the prohibition against going into a Bet Simcha for a year after the parents die. Now the Gemara comes and says, Amalaba Babarchana. We're now going to try to flesh out a little bit what we mean by Bet Simcha. And if you remember what happened last week and what's coming up now, if you try to flesh it out and it only mixes you up. Because what Rabbi Bachana says, V'lisimchat Mereut, for a Simcha of Mereut. Mereut is from Rea, friends. Ve'ahavta l'reacha kamocha. You shall love your friend, your neighbor, as yourself. So there is something called ulesimchat mereut, a friendly simcha. Apparently is different. Apparently, although it's not completely clear, because we don't know exactly how to read this. Let's see what the English says. And that which the Baraita permits a mourner for someone other than his parent to enter a house of celebration 30 days, after 30 days, where we send for anybody else but the parent, you can go in after 30 days. That, the commentator is saying here, that's true if it's a Simchat Mereut. If it's a friendly party. If it's a friendly party. But, of friends. But, to go to the Philharmonic, that's not what you call Simchat Mereut. That's called Simcha. And not Simchat Mereut. Mereut is a social gathering of friends, which is, has limitations in all likelihood to the level of the Simcha that's there. And it's not like going to a big ball. Right? That's not what we're talking about here. So, when we send that you can go after 30 days. Apparently the limitation is ulesimchat mereut, that means for a friendly party. Okay? For a friendly party. Unfortunately, it's not so clear that that's what this whole thing means, because ulesimchat mereut, maybe it means, well, from even before the 30 days are over, you could go to a Simchat Mereut. You could go to a family party. After the 30 days are over, you can go to a real party. And unfortunately, there's no way to know. Both of those are reasonable interpretations of this text. The text itself is hard to understand. I think that's where we pretty much left off last time. My word to the lawyers who were here was, if you don't write the law clearly, it can take thousands of years to figure out what's going on. And that's exactly what's happening here.
Sometimes it does.
Correct. Yes, sir.
In Steinsaltz, the halacha says that you can go to a simcha l'reyut even immediately after the shiur.
Correct. Because you know why? When we have now two possibilities in the laws of mourning, what do we learn? The general principles. It always goes l'kula. It goes to the more lenient position. And if the two possibilities are equally reasonable, the lenient position is the one that wins in the laws of mourning. That's not generally true in the law, but that's true as far as the law of mourning goes.
Why does it say ulesimcha?
That's the problem. That's what we can't figure out. It's not good either.
The question there is that not only to
but also...
Also you should avoid going to...
That's also a reasonable possibility. Sorry. It's hard. We really don't know what it means. Let me see if I have...
Rather than or?
And that's true. In the Hebrew, the vav could be and it could be or.
Right.
So could be either one. Correct.
And you're really confused.
Depends on the nikud.
No, in the Bible and in the Talmud, in the way the Talmud understands the Bible, a vav can just be either one. It depends on the context. It really depends on the context. Now, I'm just reading the Rashi in the Rashi manuscript here. The Rashi manuscript is on the left side, toward the bottom half of the page, on the far left side, about halfway down in the narrow column. Just to look at Leveta Simcha, to a Beit Simcha, Kegon Sudat Chatan. Oh, so Rashi defines the Beit Simcha refers to a Sudat Chatan. Okay, this is a wedding. We're talking about a wedding. That's what we mean by a Beit Simcha. Okay? So with a wedding, then, depending upon how we understand this, either you couldn't go to a wedding, to a Bet Simcha, for a parent for 12 months. When you're mourning for a parent, you can't go for 12 months. Okay? And if it's someone else, for the Shloshim, you could go after 30 days. You could go after 30 days. Now it goes on. Ule Simchat Mereyut. I'm still reading the Rashi. This is the Rashi manuscript. Shemitaknin Sudat Simcha Ze Im Ze. One sets up a meal for one person with another. Zein ze hayom, v'zemachar. So it's, in other words, social obligations. Okay. You have a meal with one person one day, a meal with another person machar the next day. Hold it. V'kortin brit b'nehem mishum ahava v're'ut. They have a sort of a close relationship to people, and they say, you know, we're going to meet in your house on this date, we're going to meet on your house on that date, we're going to meet on your house on the third day. Okay? That kind of thing is what we're referring to as a simchat mereyut. Okay? Now let's see what it is. Okay, let's go on with the text. Meteve. Now, the Gemara comes, and the Meteve, remember, is an objection brought to something based on a Beraita. So we're now having the Amoraim are going to bring a Beraita, which questions what we just read. Meteve. Ule Simcha Vilimereut Shloshim Yom. Here, it says, there are two things. One is called Simcha, and the other one is called Mereut, the 30 days. So in other words, they're not the same thing. They're two completely different things. And you are interpreting them as if they were the same thing. No, there's something called Simcha, and there's something called Mereut, and both of them are from the 30-day period on. Both of them are from the 30-day period on. Okay? That's not a limitation of one or the other. It's two different kinds of things. Reading the English, since the Baraita speaks of both celebration and friendship celebration, it is obvious that by celebration it means a truly joyous event which the Baraita permits after 30 days. And to that, the Gemara says, Kasha. That is a problem. It is a problem because it's a little hard just to understand what they're referring to. Now we go on. Amemar matne hache. Amemar teaches the following. Amar Rabba Bar Chana. Rabba Bar Chana, who we just saw, he was the guy that said, Ule Simcha, Ule Mereut. Okay, with two separate things. Rabba Bar Chana says, Ule Simchat Mereut Mutar Li Kanes La Alfer. For a simcha of friends, you can go in immediately. Well, what did it just say in the Maraita before? It says, for a simcha, and for a simcha of friends, you can go in after 30 days. The very next thing we have, and they hear the Gemara says, but there's another Maraita in there. The Maraita says, in Rabba Bar Chana's name. Not some unknown from out there. The same Rabba Bar Chana. It says, as far as a simchat mere'ut is concerned, a friendly simcha, a social party, mutan l'kames me'altel, you can go and do this immediately. Now, of course, immediately probably doesn't mean immediately. Immediately probably means after Shiva. After Shiva. That's not really an immediately, but probably the force of that is after Shiva. Okay?
I would think it has to be from what you...
Yeah, I mean, that's what... It doesn't say it explicitly, so I think we just have to assume that that's what it means. Let me see if we have Rashi here. Not in that Rashi, let's do the other Rashi. Nope. Okay. Then the Gemara goes on, and it says, Vahatanya, and it adds an objection, L'simcha shloshim ulemariutras. Oh, this is just repeating what we just learned on the page before. For a simcha, it's shloshim. For simchat mereyut, it's shloshim. 30 days in all of those cases. And here, the previous paraita said immediately, which is after 7 days. Okay? Lo kasha. The Gemara then answers, this is not a difficulty. This is not a difficulty. Both those paraitas make sense. But of course, the only way that it can make sense is they're talking about two different situations. So what are the two different possibilities? Ha ba'ari suta. The beraita that forbids you to have a simchat mereyut until after 30 days refers to arisuta. Arisuta. Now, arisuta means something like the beginning. The beginning. In other words, to initiate a dinner. You can't do that between the end of Shiva and Shloshim. Maybe something like this. You'll see in the I think we have commentary on this. And ha, the second case, the case of where you can do it right after Shiva, is before Anuta. For Anuta is an interesting word. It in Hebrew and Aramaic usually means punishment. For Anut, but it really means something else. Now, you know what it means? It means, and you'll understand the Hebrew once I tell it, I'll translate it into English in a different way. In English, it really means payback. Like we say in slang today, payback. Peron. It all comes from peron. Peron is when you pay back a loan. Lifroa is to pay back a loan. Okay? So in the Hebrew, the idea of puranut is God's payback. Payback. And you never want to say punishment. In Hebrew, why don't you want to say punishment? Because it's bad. In Hebrew, you will never say anything bad that has to do with the Jews. You can't say it directly. You have to say it by euphemism. So puranut, which we think means punishment, doesn't mean punishment. It means payback. So in other words, the people get their payback, what they deserve. Which, of course, is what? Punishment. But you would never say punishment, because it's not nice. It's not nice. You never want to think you really deserve a punishment. The Jews should deserve a punishment. So what Arisuta and Puranuta are in terms of social obligations. Puranuta is you've been invited to somebody else's house. What do you have to do after that? You have to reciprocate. If you're in the position of having the social obligation of reciprocation, you can do that right after Shiva. But to start this whole thing right after Shiva, it's not nice. It's not nice. So then you wait till after Shloshim. Okay? Arisuta is if you're going to start this whole system of friendly gatherings, you have to wait till after Shloshim. But if it's already taken place, and therefore it's on the books, and you really have a social obligation to others, that social obligation shouldn't be forgotten. and it's appropriate, therefore, and you can do it after Shiva. Okay? That, now, let's just read the commentaries here, so we see exactly what we're talking about. Ari Sutta, I'm reading in the Rashi manuscript. Halva'a, says here. Kolomar, Ari Sutta means halva'a. Now, I don't know what halva'a means, to tell you the truth. I don't think it means loan here. I think what it means is it's from livui. We would say in modern Hebrew something like livui, accompanying.
So why would it
because that is the way they created the noun from lamed vav he.
Yeah.
Milave is to accompany somebody, but malve is to loan. It's the loan. So there's probably a connection between the two. I suspect there's a connection between the two. I don't know exactly what it is. But Arisuta is Alvara Kolomar. Achshav Machil Hareut. Now the friendship or the social events begin. Vuhu Machilotachila. And this person, the mourner, as it were, is the first one of the three friends to start. Okay? To start. V'hu matchil re'ut. V'hu matchilo techila shloshim yom. So if that's the case, you wait for 30 days. Right? The next one is bepuranuta. When we're talking about payback, social obligations, Shekvar Sa'ad Hu Imahem. He has already eaten in their houses. Mishelahem, from their food. Kama Pyamin, several times. Va'achshav, Higiyazman Lifroa. Now is the time for payback. He has to reciprocate. Horea lialter. He has to reciprocate immediately. Mitnation mechuyav lahem kfar. Because he has already developed a debt to them. It's like, okay, so that may be the halva'a. Right, it's returning the debt. It's paying off a debt. Paying off a debt. Once you have a social obligation has reality to it. And therefore, it is permissible for you to act on a social obligation. Okay? So it's a subtle kind of a thing here, but that's how the Gemara now solves the problem between these two varieties, which are contradictory. One which says that you do it after 30 days, and the other one that says after 7 days. They're just two different situations.
What if you made the commitment before?
If it was tefillah, it doesn't matter. A commitment could be put off, but not a social obligation that's a result of somebody else having served you. Okay?
I was just wondering, there's strict rules on the mourning for parents. Does that include step-parents?
Parents include step-parents? Not really. No, it doesn't. Unless you could describe to me a case where step-parents function as parents, in which case I would say yes. But technically the answer is no.
Thank you.
Does this, assuming this is actually part of the halakha and how it's practiced nowadays, does this require some degree of formality, or is this sort of open-ended? In other words, I can see it sort of being a good way to ease people back into being social, and also being good reason that we should always be inviting each other over, so we have that opportunity to reciprocate. But is this not to be understood that casually, or?
I don't know the answer to that. But as far as I know, this is not dealt with in halacha. I don't know of this being dealt with in halacha. I'm not aware of this ever becoming halacha itself. But that's not to say that it might not be, or that there are not communities that, in fact, have developed certain practical customs as a result of this gemara. That wouldn't be unusual. Any other questions? Yes.
It does seem, again, that the Tanaim, at least, had a kind of struggle always when issues came up between obligation of the individual to the chevra and the obligation of the community to
the individual,
whether it's to impose certain limits or to observe certain restrictions with regard to the individual. And generally speaking, they seem to feel the obligation that the individual has in the community outweighs, no matter how serious the circumstances.
That's a good point. So that would carry through here again, wouldn't it? That if you have an obligation to other people, who are therefore your community, that outweighs the situation where you don't have that obligation, at least. So when you're in the position of having the obligation, you have to follow through on it.
Doesn't really imply that when you are mourning for someone other than your parents, it's not that serious.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's a pretty serious circumstance.
Mm-hmm.
Nevertheless, you have a pending obligation, or the Yom Tov is coming, or you have to put those personal situations aside, or the society makes you put those.
That's
kind of a, I mean, it's a pretty interesting idea for me.
Yeah, no, it's a very interesting idea. Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay? Let's go on. Lokasha. Okay, now we're at 22b2. Last side of the page, last paragraph. The Varaita goes on now and uses the same form to introduce a slightly different subject. Al kol amitim kulam korea tefach al aviv v'alimo ad shiyegale et libo. For all of the people that you are mourning, you, when you rend the garment, you rend the garment a tefach. Tefach means a hand's breadth, and halachically that's considered 3.5 inches. 3.5 inches. Okay? So you have to make a rend in the garment of 3.5 inches. Alavi v'alimo ad shigale et libo. For his father and his mother, literally until he exposes his heart. Probably it means that you have to, if you start up on top, it probably means that you have to rend a rent long enough so that in fact you get through. Alibo means the chest. Now what is unclear here is whether you're actually exposing the skin. That could be understood from the text that for Aviv v'Imo, in fact, you have to make such a rend that it does expose the skin. Okay? Now, don't want to say anything about it yet, because we'll be seeing this in greater detail. Amar Rabbi Abahu Maikra. Rabbi Abahu says, what is the scriptural source for this, that you have to rend the garment a tefach, a hand's breadth? Vayichazek David bivagadav vayikra'en. This was after Saul and Jonathan and their army suffered tremendous defeat and they were killed. News comes back to David and David rends his garment. And the language is vayichazek, that he held on to it. Vayichazek David bivagadav. He holds on to his garment and he rends. The ein achiza pachot mitefach. When the term achiza, holding on, is used, you naturally hold on with your hand. And therefore, when we say that somebody holds on to something, it means a hand's breadth. Right? That's the amount that it refers to. So that then is, according to Rabbi Abahu, that's the scriptural source for that amount. Okay? Now, let's go on a little bit further. Al kol ha-metim kulam, again, same form, for all deceased relatives, assuming without, with the exception of father and mother, afilu lavush asara chalukim. Mm-hmm. Even if a person is dressed with a chaluk in the Talmud, usually means chaluk in the Talmud means a shirt. A shirt is a chaluk, a shirt. Realize that in the Talmud, probably the image that we have here is more or less the best comparison is probably Arab dress or Roman dress. Okay, so it's something like that, either Arab or Roman dress. You're talking about a robe, or you're talking about a tunic, a Roman type tunic that somebody is wearing. Okay, that's more or less what we're talking about. So even if you're wearing 10 of them, that's the Talmud's way of talking about something. It doesn't say if you have two of them. It says even if you have 10 of them. Okay? Even if you have 10 of them, eino korea ela elyon. You only rend the top one. Okay? There we go. That's now we're getting into this here, because if you're only rending the top one, then obviously you're not exposing the skin. Not exposing the skin. Now, Allah the Alimo, for his father and for his mother, Korea et Kulahan. One rends all of them. That is now exposing the skin, as it were. That is exposing the skin. Okay? The apikar suto eina miyakevet, and his apikar suit doesn't get in the way of fulfilling the obligation. Now here, apikar suit is translated in the English as his kerchief. Let's just go that far. Let's see number 17. Number 17. The translation follows Rashi. It does not hold back. He need not rend the kerchief, even though it drapes on his shoulder, and thus might be construed as a covering for his body, which would require rending. Alternatively, eino me'akev quite literally means it does not hold back. That is, although the kerchief sometimes drapes over the rent in the garment, hiding it from view, this does not hold back or compromise the mourner's fulfillment of the rending obligation, which in general requires that the rent be exposed. Now, next one is the key thing. Some render apikar suto as a type of overcoat. Others, however, render it as his undershirt. His undershirt. That is the shirt that is pressed against the skin. Let me see if I have the Rambam here. No, I don't have it here. The shirt that is pressed against the skin. Since that shirt is intended to absorb perspiration rather than as an actual garment, it is not a garment that it should require rending. Right? Now this actually happens to be crucial.
Even for a parent?
Especially for a parent. The issue is really for the parent. What we have seen here is that, first of all, there is the difference in the law of rending for a parent and for a non-parent. For a non-parent, one is required to rend a tefach in the garment. For a parent, one is required to rend which either means a very long tear, or in addition to that, if he is wearing 10 chalukim, he's got to rend all of them. But the limitation on that is that you don't in fact have to expose the skin, because the lowest garment that is against the skin has another purpose to it, and it doesn't have the purpose of being a garment, as it were. It has the purpose of absorbing perspiration. Interestingly enough, this in fact is halacha. Two things I want to point out a minute. First of all, If you read Rabbi Lamb's book, Morning, the Jewish way of the morning, Lamb speaks about the rending of the garment. And nowhere does Lamb ever mention that there's a difference between parents and other people. If you read any of the other books that I recommended to you, Weiss's book or the Art Scrolls book, they tell you that there is a difference between renting for a parent and for a non-parent. Several years ago, I was brought up on Lamb's book. Lamb's book was always the first that we used. Comrigan came to me several years ago and said, my brother's a member of X-Shul, and I'm a member of Mishul, and my brother told me that when we make kriya for our father, we have to rend all of our garments. Is this true? I heard the question, and the truth is, I never heard of it before. Because Lamb mentions nothing about it. Absolutely nothing. I just did a little bit of research, and of course it is true. You just read it. This is salacha. Salacha is different for parents. So in fact, the law is that for a parent, one rends every garment with the exception of an overcoat. If your normal dress inside is, let's say, the way I'm dressed now, you would start with the jacket. After the jacket would come the shirt. And probably that's all that would be done. Because I, for example, are wearing two garments underneath that. One is what you call an arba kanfot, that has tzitzit on it, and that's not a garment that's worn as a regular garment. It's a special mitzvah garment. Okay, it's not a regular garment. Then an undershirt. So you don't tear the arba kanfot, you don't tear the undershirt, but you tear what is on top of it. Okay? In this particular case, they also wanted the rabbi said you also have to tear the overcoat. That's too extreme. The sources that I know would never say that. You don't have to tear an overcoat. The indoor garments that you would wear, and normally you don't wear an overcoat indoors. So that in fact is halacha. And it is not actually exposing the flesh. That's not the issue here. The issue comes to be an unusually large rent, and that is to some extent defined by the number of garments that you are rending in the case of the parent. Generally speaking, this halacha in the American Jewish community has always been unknown, and I never had the opportunity to ask Rabbi Lamb why he did not include that in his book, but I think I know why. Because it seemed too bizarre. You notice that frequently in the laws of mourning, there is a recognition that things may be perceived as bizarre. And when that is the case, in fact, they go out of custom. The customs disappear. Turning over the bed, we saw that. We saw one last week. What was that? We saw another bizarre custom. I can't remember what it was. What? Yes, that was the correct. Well, that was bearing the shoulder. That was specifically described as bearing the shoulder, and that we saw had gone out of style. Right? That was no longer practiced. And one of the reasons was that the Gentiles would think that it was too bizarre. And we live among Gentiles, and that this would strike them as being too bizarre. Whatever it is, Jewish communities were, in fact, sensitive to that, and that's what they saw. Here, my hunch is that in the mainstream orthodoxy in America was in no way as strict as it is today. Today, orthodoxy has become much stricter than it was just a relatively few years ago. And in those days, in fact, Lamb was speaking for mainline Orthodoxy.
Is the hearth there just to identify a landmark, or does it have...
No, it has symbolic significance. Because also, we'll see this, I think, elsewhere, the side on which you rend is different for parent and for the others. The parent, you rend on the left side over the heart. The others, you rend on the right side.
So what was the symbolism of the heart?
The symbolism of the heart is heart.
Life.
It's life. The love
is the life.
I love it. I mean, it's love.
What?
Love.
The love.
I think it's closest to what we would call love.
Yeah. Yeah. The heart was the seat of the thought.
I think here heart
here,
is...
but in general, you use that
correct,
word.
Correct. That is true. But having said that, it's still...
So.
Good question. In fact, the rend that is made for the non-parent could be done or could be started by the rabbi. And what the rabbi should do is to start a rend and then say to somebody, now you tear. You tear. That's the way we usually do it. In fact, it depends on the circumstances what actually you can do. Because with our modern clothing, frequently it's very hard to do that. And you'll see we're going to read in a little bit about exactly where on the garment you tear. And it's not easy to tear a garment. If you tear, for example, you'll see that the proper tear on a shirt starts about here. It starts at roughly at the neckline. It can't be on a seam. And it has to be a tefach. Okay? So here you're talking essentially... this. Now, frankly, to get from here to here, you didn't know you can do that on your own. Because you've got a, I don't know what you call this, what do you call this, a flap? Placket. Very good. So you're great. You know this. Right, it's a placket, right. You've got a placket here, and it's very difficult to tear. So, in reality, what you have to do is that you have to do some of this with an implement. For the parent, you should do the entire tear. And you should do it by yourself. It's rarely done. Because it's just so impractical. So what you end up doing is somebody helps you to get started and then you say, you know, pull it now yourself. Some people do it, you know, with a lot of energy. A lot of people just find it hard to do. And that's the tradition there. There's another hand? Yes.
It just occurred to me that at the time and place this was written, the way of dress was completely different.
That's why I think you have to keep this in mind, that the way of dress was different, but some of the principles are the same. You'll see we're going to develop this in a moment. Even what we've seen so far, you get a sense that it's almost the drama of the thing that's really important. There's a drama to it. It's a very emotional thing to do. It requires energy, expenditure of a certain amount of investment and energy in it. So all of those things are related, and also it involves the public. A rend in the garment is a very public statement. It's a very public statement. People will tell me today, for example, generally I find most Jews who know about these things, if you ask, why do you rend the garment, they'll come and give me the following answer. So that other people will know I'm mourning. Right? And ever so many rabbis give that reason as the reason for rending.
Logical.
Right? But I don't think it's correct. But it is logical. It is, I mean, it's a logical reason. So again, that's to emphasize the public side of this. I think it's a byproduct of it. I think that's really what it is. It's a real byproduct, and therefore, you know, a real part of it. I mean, I'm not denying that. I think the deeper meaning of it is not to show other people that you're mourning, but it is a cathartic action. It's an action that by itself is horrendous. And as I said to people, it's a way of saying on the outside how you feel on the inside. And it's such a primitive thing. It's a very, very primitive thing to do to rip the garment. And I would note to you as well that it's also, even halachically, it's a problem. We have laws against tearing garments.
Oh.
It's a destructive act. You are not allowed to go and just tear something up. It's called the law of Bal Tashchit. Law of Bal Tashchit is that you are not allowed to have wanton destruction in the creation. And if somebody has made something, you're not allowed to destroy it unless there be sufficient reason for it. So wanton destruction is against halacha. So normally, you're not allowed to destroy your clothing. You're not allowed to destroy your clothing. That's, and it's important to see that context. In this one case, you are obligated to destroy your clothing. Although, as you will see, it's appropriate also to sew it up afterwards. You're dealing with an economy where the assumption is that you will sew something up afterwards.
Well, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, well, you'll see. Well, we're going to see it here in detail. It's not that simple. Again, it's going to depend. The parental situation is different from the other situation.
And you're going to wear that garment just for shiva, right?
Right.
So
today people will tell me, many rabbis will tell them to wear it for 30 days.
Okay,
I think the law is
shiva. If you wear it just for shiva, anyone who sees you knows that you're mourning anyway.
Correct. It's one of the reasons. I don't think that's the principal reason.
You can wear a black ribbon and cut the ribbon and people know you're mourning.
Well, because that comes to be a sign. Like wearing a sign. You know, I am mourning.
The notion of stereotype spontaneity is fascinating. So you're emulating an act, a spontaneous act on the part of King David, in which he violates the rules in the midst of mourning. And mourning, the overwhelming response to mourning is to in fact violate the rules because of the intensity of the emotion. But the notion of a pattern, stereotypic recapitulation of a spontaneous act.
I would say you should be sure that his is a spontaneous act. Because it's very possible, as we know in the Bible, it always says the same thing. So maybe these were conventions that in fact were part of life. And that the news about death had with it from ancient times a convention. You know, maybe the first time it was done, it was spontaneous.
Right.
Whatever that was. But by the time you have society, in fact, all the records are that this was a convention.
Also reminds me of oneself.
Most of the mourning laws are reminders to oneself, lest you either don't think about it or don't take it seriously.
Yeah, I mean, it's really a reminder oneself, but it also ensures that the entire community behaves in a certain way and reinforces the convention so that somebody is not outside of it. And I guess it's to protect somebody who wouldn't have that spontaneous reaction.
Mm-hmm. It's true.
Appearing to not be a caring one.
Exactly. You don't want to expose such things in public, which could be one of the reasons why we say the Kaddish also for the 11 months and then for 12 months. You don't want to, if somebody really needs a lot of Kaddish, by that I mean the deceased needs a lot of words up there, you know, in order to get a fairly decent trial. You don't want to say that out loud. So we don't want to make any differences between the way we treat anybody, even though some people need a lot more treatment than other people. But we don't want to say that in public. Okay, now look how it keeps, look how it goes on after that. So far we said, we put instead of this being kerchief, I don't think it's the kerchief, this means the undershirt. The undershirt is kriyomyakev. What that means is, if you don't cut the undershirt, it doesn't mean you haven't made the kriya. You haven't made the rim. It could be. I mean, it could be either, but it as he describes, as Rashi describes it, it's something that falls over, you know, it could be a long headscarf, let's say, that falls over the chest. And therefore, it can cover the rent. So what we are saying is that even if the headscarf falls over the chest and it covers the rent, it's okay. You still have made the rent, you don't have to make a rent in that headscarf. Okay, that's the meaning of the Rashi there.
Just
let me
see if I missed
anything. Yeah, let me see, just explains what I just explained. I have to read it. Okay. Now the Baraita goes on. Echad ha'ish ve'echad ha'isha. Yeah. That's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's the same for men as it is for women. Same for men as it is for women. Now, as far as what we have read here in the Baraita goes, it is possible to read, if we understand this the way Rashi understood it, we have said that you have to cut through all of your garments. You have to tear through all of the garments of the parent. Now we're saying it's the same for men as it is for women. That's surprising, because there is tremendous concern always with women's modesty. Okay? A man could have flesh exposed. The idea that a woman's chest would be exposed, we can't even say it. Okay? It's not something that we would permit. So, strangely enough, the Baraita says,
I don't think
it means
the same. I think one is two separate things.
What do you mean? What do you mean?
Yes.
Right, so what do you think it means? I don't get it. One way for a man and one way for a woman. Like that. I see. Well, that's not the way the Gemara understands. That's okay. Because now Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar omer, Aisha korat et atachton, umachzirato lacharel. Well, it could be, because now he's explaining maybe what it said before. Either he's opposing it or he's explaining it. Right. He's explaining that each is different. The woman tears the bottom garment, umachzirato lacharel. And then she's got to tear multiple garments also for her parent. Right? For the other person, it doesn't matter, because she's wearing several garments, she just tears the top garment. That was okay. The problem one is for the parent. She's got to tear all the way down. Assuming she has two garments, what does she do? She tears the top garment and tears it. Turns that garment around, puts it in the back. Then she tears the garment underneath. Okay? Then she takes the first garment and turns it back. Okay? So she has cut down to the flesh, but she's not exposing the flesh. Right? It's being covered. Let's see, 19, I think, explains this. For the sake of modesty.
Let's see
the way they explain it. For the sake of modesty, a woman mourning her father or mother first renders her inner garment so that her skin remains covered by her outer garment. Okay? She then turns the rent to the back, so that when she rends the outer garment, her skin remains covered by the back of the inner garment. That's right. She starts in the bottom, and then she turns it around. So then when she cuts the outer garment, there will be a visible tear, right? Because it's on the outer garment. It's on the outer garment, but it won't show through to the skin. That'll be covered. Okay? According to the Rambam, who explains that the undershirt need not be rent in any case, we must apparently say that women did not generally wear such undershirts. Okay. Alternatively, it is a breach of modesty for a woman to expose her undershirt. That's also true. Either way, the obvious concern here is for female modesty.
What about the scarf? She's permitted to have the scarf covered.
Well, we go further than that.
And what happens to the covering of the face and the head and all of that?
Well, it's there, but it's not this. This is different. This is the rending of the garment. So you would rend this garment. You can imagine what you look like if you do all of these things. You rend all the garments on the outside, cover the face over with the Apipat HaRosh. You look like you came from another planet. My hunch, I don't know the answer to that. I don't know. It's a good question. The interesting thing, I never thought of that. When you go to a French museum to see these old pictures that I think about, I'm just trying to think, I actually have stuff at home.
This is medieval?
Russia's 11th century. So I have, if you, those of you who know my house, you've been to my house, you know we have these tapestries, which are Belgian reproductions of Belgian tapestries in about 1200 or so. It's roughly that time, and the women are wearing flowing robes. It's very ornate, as the men are. They're wearing large cross-dressing, as it were. from a modern person's perspective, they seem to be dressing an awful lot alike. It's going to be interesting to see clothing in these different environments in order to understand what they're talking about. Because in all likelihood, they're talking from their own reality.
But those are the clothing of the well-to-do.
Correct. You'd have to take that into account and to see also whether you have other people's clothing. You can think of the peasant type of paintings, Bruegel's paintings, where you have peasants. An interesting perspective on things I never thought about. Later. So it would be interesting to see that earlier period. I would assume.
There were very few Jewish peasants.
I'm not sure because keep in mind, what did Rashi do for a living? And Rashi was a farmer. He was a vintner. He couldn't make money from Talmud, you can. He grew grapes and distilled them. He lived in Champagne. I'm sure he produced champagne. So, I don't know exactly who worked the fields, but I suspect that the family probably did these things. I don't know how these things actually worked. I wouldn't be surprised if it worked like that. In the medieval world, we think of it as totally structured feudally. I doubt that that's the case. I mean, it may be generally true, but I suspect that people have private plots of land as well. Just for the Jewish stuff, because Jews never owned, Jews are not part of the feudal system, they're kept out of that system. So, but you do know that people like Rashi were farmers. That's why Rashi's commentaries in that area are invaluable. All of his commentaries to the Talmud deal with agriculture. Are extraordinary because he knew agriculture.
It's possible.
Could be.
If a congregant came to you tomorrow, said, Rabbi, I know there's this custom or this law about rending the garment. What should I do? What would you tell? Are you mad?
So my first question to you is, what law? What law are you saying?
Just rending the garment.
First of all, you have to rend the garment. Okay? The way the conversation usually would go would be somebody would say, but I thought that we use ribbons.
Right. Or I've seen ribbons, right?
Right. Or I've seen ribbons. Most people at this stage of the game think that that's what halacha is. They assume that that's what's done. So I would say, well, it is done. That's the way people have come to get used to things. But really what's meant is rending the garment. And I think if you want to do it in a traditional way, you should really rend the garment. If you don't want to do that, it's a problem, then use the ribbon. But I think it makes sense because it's really a rending of clothing. And it's really a sense of the drama and the pathos that is in an action like that. And I think that to just do it with a little thing is, in a way, it's ruining something that makes good psychological sense. You were here when Sam said that, right?
Yeah.
You heard what Sam Klaasman said when we had that session 2 weeks ago. Last Monday. A week from Monday. Sam Klaasman, we go through all these warning things and says, well, I have something I want to say. And he then describes this, from the psychiatrist's perspective, how important rending the garment is. That he feels that it is just one of the most important actions that actually is done.
The sound.
The sound, right? Just the sound of it. And it's a very powerful sound. But it's important in the self-recognition of what has happened. So that's what I would say. Then, if I knew I were dealing with somebody who was really, let's say, a high level, I would say, and you know that the Talmud actually discusses the difference in rending for a parent and for others. There's actually a custom of rending for the parent more than just one garment. But I wouldn't say that to most people. Because I think that what Rabbi Lamb is right. He took the middle road and did what was right for American Jews. So I'd only do it if I felt that.
So
I was dealing with people who were incipient extremists. Like,
so you tell a man, your shirt would be appropriate?
Yes. I say that the best thing is probably the shirt. But that it's okay, and this is a halachic discussion which we have in America, and most of the mainline rabbis agree that the tie is also all right. Tie is an interesting
question. It's all visible.
For a long time, the tie was not accepted, and today it's also becoming not accepted again because of the move to the right. Many rabbis will no longer accept the tie. But I agree with the tie as being good for a lot of reasons. First of all, it's a tefach. It's easy. It's in it, and it is the right size. Secondly, it's in the right place. It's pretty much in the right place. Thirdly, it's very public. Very public part of it.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think there's anything wrong with it. So it seems to me that the tie is sometimes a desirable thing. And I find that for people who come out of our environment, it's as Lamb said, I think I mentioned to you once before, Lamb points out, he says that when people had nothing, they tore their clothes. When people had everything, they tore their ribbons.
Hmm.
And so the more we have, the less they'll tear. Right? So there's a point to that, and a real point to that too. But I think there's something also dramatic about using the actual clothes itself. And what you do is that you tear the shirt, just like that, for a parent, or you go on this side for anyone else. Okay, and we'll see more details about this coming up. Robin?
There's an interesting contradiction here. If we say that the rending is a release of emotion, the halacha, the Talmud doesn't want you to react, let's say, like King David did, on hearing the news of the death of Jonathan, to let his emotions essentially overcome it. You actually have to wait.
It depends. It's an interesting issue of halacha. Maybe we'll get to that. There are differences of opinion about when to do it. When to make clear is a discussion in halacha, because there is one perspective that you do it at the moment of death. If you are present when somebody dies, you immediately make clear. All the people who are present make clear when you are present at a death. That's one perspective. Another perspective is that you do it soon, relatively soon thereafter, or you do it at the funeral, or you do it after the funeral. The prevailing custom in America is to do it at the funeral. Usually do it before you start the service itself. But I don't know about elsewhere. Ron, what do you
think? In Israel, they do it in the cemetery, well, the gathering, mm-hmm. and the rabbis say, or the guy who runs the show, say one few words, and then he goes to the sun, and he starts a tale, and he says, continue. And you know to bring not the best clothes, you know. That
but I always tell people that. When I meet with people before, I always go through that. So they shouldn't be caught last minute with something they don't want to, that you don't want to tear. You have to know this ahead of time.
And then you continue the cut as much as you want.
Correct.
Or the kids or whatever, and then you continue with the clothes. And it tells you to keep this shirt or whatever for the whole week. Mm-hmm. I mean, to right. wear it the whole week.
How don't we do it when we're here? Isn't that when David did it?
Correct. That's what I'm saying. Then one of the customs is that you do it when you hear it. But that has not become...
He was witnessing it. He didn't witness it.
Oh, I see. Hearing. I see what you said. There is also that custom.
And
there is such a custom. And as a matter of fact, that's generally not halacha. Except in the following case. Let's say burial took place and you hear later delayed news. You get the news. When you get the news, you're supposed to ring. When you get the news, you
but this is someone close enough to mourn for it.
But you didn't know about it. Right.
It's not necessarily a public event.
It depends.
We do it
privately.
Before coming, after everybody's
correct.
That's up to the families.
That's in America, you do it in the woman.
Correct. And in Israel, you do it publicly, don't you? Yeah. In Israel, I would assume you do it publicly. Because halacha is that for the parents, for the non-parents, you could do it privately. But for the parents, it should be done publicly. There's a difference. But that's not our custom in America. We don't do it. We don't do it like that. Let's go a little bit further.
In Israel, by the way, there is no private session at all. You know, it's interesting. The whole
correct.
The gathering is in one place
correct.
For the family. And
it's only in America we have separate rooms for things. We have a lot of rooms in America. I think it's because we're affluent. I think it's because the whole idea of having a funeral chapel, it's an American thing. It's only Americans. It's all free enterprise. You know, people go into the business. America, it becomes a business. The rest of the world, they would never think of a business funeral home. They'd have a business. I remember when I was a kid, we had in the next town, I went to a public school. So in the next town, they had a very large Protestant funeral home. Was called the Burns Chapel. Burns Chapel. And Susan Burns was in our class. So her father was the local undertaker. So, you know, whenever you'd have the class would go around and you'd say, what does your father do? An engineer, my father's a doctor. And Susan, what does your father do? My father is the undertaker. So the teacher, we had one teacher, always used to say, and they're dying to get in. Poor Susan Burns. She lived with this in every class. That's only in America. People have a family business. It's called undertaking. I don't think it's done anywhere else in the world. We have a very interesting culture we live in.
I have to say, his name is Harvey Bookbinder, his father.
Was a bookbinder and undertaker?
Yeah. There's actually a new book out, a woman who grew up in an undertaker family. She did her own biography in like a comic book, in the new mode, like Mouse, with the stories. In the graphic novel, yeah. Thank you. It's got some very good reviews.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody wants the name of it, I'll find it for them.
I read it. I liked it. It's a great story.
Is that an undertaker's family?
Well, yes. And her growing up, her father would take her downstairs, and she'd see all the, you know, the bodies are going to be fixed up for the viewing, and also her story about growing up, just because she's got a father and a mother, and they're, you know, it's a dysfunctional family. So a lot of that too, but the occupation of the family was sort of tied up with this funeral home.
On 116th Street, I was told to some of the funeral home owners, and it was a couple who owned the funeral home, young. She brought her baby to help out. You know, she brought her baby from home, and she put him in a casket to sleep. Kidding, tell the difference. She said, I don't know, he's leaving.
In the case like of all that.
I said, just don't close
cover.
Oh, she always thinks of that. No.
In the case of Jonathan, the son of Saul, King Saul, he died in battle as a casualty. Does it make any difference in the morning room?
Not really, except insofar as there would be time delays, maybe, or finding the bodies, things like that, which are issues of war time. It's difficult to say. Okay. We have enough time for a little more? Let's see what's next year. Well, we'll just start the next piece. I'll tell you another story. Just before
that's your memory.
this is called short-term memory. This is from dinner. I mentioned to you, some of you, I think, that I just had dinner with Dr. C. Fine, who is the director of the Joint Distribution Committee, who is the source of Orza Ruiz's Ner Tamid. He is the one who got for us the Ner Tamid from Romania. And he had given me this book, which I'm giving to Bobby, to show the source. We have a picture of Orza Ruiz's Ner Tamid in its original source, in the Chorale Synagogue in Bucharest. And we were talking about a number of things. Some of them were the burial customs of Yerushalayim. These are things that Yerushalmim deal with. I'm a resident of Jerusalem. He's a resident of Jerusalem. So we talk shop talk, you know, with family things. So he mentioned to me that there are customs of Jerusalem that are just different. And they're not the same in the rest of Israel. And I've never been to an Israeli funeral, so I don't really have personal experience with these things. So he said that the custom of Yerushalayim, for example, is you're not allowed to be buried in a coffin.
Except soldiers in Israel, nobody's buried in a coffin.
So all soldiers...
Only soldiers buried in boxes.
That's right.
Soldiers are buried in boxes? Yes,
only soldiers.
Only soldiers.
Because they might be named? No, because they might be moved. Because when you bury a soldier, he's usually buried in the military cemetery, and the family has the right to move it to any place they want. So they want the soldier's body always to be in one place and not completely.
Very interesting. That's how about where was your father buried?
In Tel Aviv? Yalkon Cemetery.
In the Yalkon Cemetery.
Tel Aviv, yeah.
So right outside of Tel Aviv.
Outside of Tel Aviv.
So did they use a box?
No, I told you last time, what they do, they dig in and they put the cement block around so they have some space. They put the body.
The body, mamash the body.
With the tachlitin. And then they put a cover with a little, which is another cement plaque or something. Mm-hmm. And then they put the soil, the ground.
So there is no wooden box.
No wooden box at all, nothing.
It should make sense also in Israel that Israel doesn't have wood.
Doesn't have wood, and Israel doesn't have water. Okay. So there's an issue.
I mean,
I'm still
like New Orleans.
Yeah, New Orleans, you know,
right.
But the only people were buried in wood caskets.
Are the soldiers. I see.
Isn't the outside
the
city walls
of Jerusalem? Yeah, you can't be buried inside the city. Inside the walls.
The
Talmud is full of it, all the laws about being buried outside the walls of Jerusalem.
That's
of course,
right,
I was going to say, the walls being spoken about in the Talmud are not the same walls that are there today. The walls that are there today are from Saladin. So they're much more recent, the 16th century, which in a city like Jerusalem is called yesterday. They're brand new walls. But otherwise you have to be outside the walls. If you walk around the old city, for example, you'll see immediately outside the walls are the Arab graveyards. So that if you just, even the road that goes around the old city, if you look up on the East Jerusalem side, is a Muslim burial ground. But it's actually outside the walls. It's outside the walls of the city. Okay? No questions? Very good. Let's call it there, and we'll pick up from that. You're welcome. Next week, do we have a Hanukkah party next week?
We do.
Okay, so we'll study, and we'll also party.
That's what I think of
doing. Halava. Halava. Next week is Halavai, there's the Halava.
What would be fun?
Okay, Jim. What can you report?
Well, the problem is that Albert doesn't know the password to the computer. I've tried calling her, so I can't log on. So I've installed the software, but you can't write an offer out of it.